Hi, everybody. Today's Thursday, September 4th, 2025, and our friend Scott Reeder is back with us. Welcome back, Scott.
Thanks for having me.
Scott, we had the summit, the SCO summit in China, and India, in my opinion, was the difference. And after years, they participated in this sort of gathering. And first of all, why did India decide to participate? It was about the negotiations, because we had the Chinese foreign minister going to India before that. It seems that they officially made everything possible, everything, and, you know, facilitate the process of decision-making on the part of the Indians. Your take on that?
Well, first of all, we need to understand that India is a member of the SCO, Shanghai Cooperation Organization. So why wouldn't they participate?
Are you connected to your mic? It seems that the mic that you're using is not as the same mic that we...
We can use this one.
Yeah, yeah.
Or we can use this one. You pick.
The first one.
Yeah, that's what I got.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. I was just saying, there is every reason for India. I mean, why wouldn't India be there?
Scott,
they're a member.
Yeah, you may change it, because it's when your voice is just going up and down. I don't know what's that.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on either. How about this? This more consistent?
Yeah, good. Go ahead. All right. Sorry for that.
No, look, India was going to participate. The question is, what level of participation and what would the outcome be? Look, India and China have been working to repair relations for some time now. Last year or 2 years ago, I guess, in Kazan, Putin, brought Modi and Xi together, and there was supposed to be this promise to, repair relations. But, they've got some big sticking points, and one of the biggest sticking points is border security and such. And that's still an issue. People tend to forget that in 2020, Indian soldiers and Chinese soldiers were killing each other on that border. And there continues to be high levels of tension to this date. There's also concerns about trade. China's economic domination of the Indo-Pacific region, and concerns on the part of India that, if they don't, develop the ability to, push back against China, et cetera, and then they'll be weakened by, Chinese economic domination. There's also concerns about China's relationship with Pakistan. There just was a shooting war between India and Pakistan, where Chinese military support to Pakistan played a critical role. And I think India is also worried about deepening relations between Russia and China. India has always had, sort of Russia as an anchor for its, military procurement and things of that nature. And they see, closer relations. So there was a lot of impetus on the part of India to maybe put the brakes on, jumping in with 2 feet on BRICS and on the SCO, and sort of straddle the fence and see what the West could offer. But what India found out is the West doesn't offer anything, especially the United States. The United States seeks to treat India as a colonial, a colonial property, demanding that India violate, critical issues of its sovereignty when it comes to, the choices India makes, for instance, on energy security, where to source their oil and gas. And so this was the critical thing, because I don't know if Modi would have gone to China otherwise. He probably would have dispatched his foreign minister and such. But Modi went as a clear signal to the United States, to President Trump, that India is not going to be bullied by the United States, who has imposed, stiff tariffs on India, secondary sanctions, so to speak, for continuing to buy Russian energy. And I think this is a strategic shift. There's still a lot of problems, but the Indians, together with the Russians and Chinese, began a dialogue. that's designed to overcome these problems and solidify the relationship now that is glued by their common objections to America's pursuit of a global hegemony based upon a rules-based international order that Russia and China divorced from a long time ago, and now it looks like India is divorcing from it as well. This is very problematic for the United States. This is something that can break America's economic back, isolate America dramatically on the global stage. I'm not going to sit here and say there's no chance for America to repair relations, but I would say right now, given the very poor advice that Donald Trump's receiving from his Secretary of State, Secretary of Treasury, and others, that that doesn't appear that the Trump administration has either the desire or the tool set to that would be needed to fix relations with India. Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping certainly do, and it looks like this is going to go down in history as one of those strategic decision points where the United States finally pushed India off the fence into the arms of China and Russia.
Isn't that amazing that Donald Trump, he says that it's too late for India to come back. So I don't know what's going on in his mind that it's too late for India to have a better relationship with the United States, because look at the situation between Russia and China. They're in some sort of partnership that nobody is able to separate one from another. And I don't know how long does it take for the administration in Washington to understand the reality and the nature of the relationship that India has with Russia and China. It seems to me that it's going to be, in the near future, it's going to be too late for the United States to improve that, as it happened with the case of China and Russia.
Yeah, if we apply traditional, ways of thinking to this problem set, it makes no sense. I mean, Donald Trump is literally committing geopolitical suicide as we speak, willingly so. So willingly that it makes one wonder whether this is deliberate or not. I mean, you and I, we start talking as if this is a big mistake on the part of the United States. But, I've just spent a lot of time scratching my head going, why would he do this? It's so blatantly obvious that it's going to lead to failure, unless failure is what he's trying to achieve. And why would I think that? I think Donald Trump, when you parse out past speeches that he's made, has talked about, America's pretty much overcommitted around the world. We've taken on the role of the world's policeman. We've, committed ourselves here, there, and everything, and we've diluted our strength. And then you look at, some of the foundational policies that he's engaged in. I believe that Trump is heading towards a fortress America, that Trump is actually trying to break free of entanglements, and in many ways to encourage, power structures to emerge that would create a balance in the world today. The rules-based international order just doesn't work. It's falling apart. It's chaos. And if the United States continues to try and, repair this, we're just going to sink. This is like trying to float the Titanic after it hit the iceberg. It's time to jump off the Titanic and get on the rescue ship and complete the voyage. And I think that it's the only thing that makes sense in my mind is that Donald Trump, is serious about creating a northern, southern, north-south America economic bloc dominated by the dollar, dominated by the United States, to have a weak and subservient Europe that will be linked to America, energy-wise, dollar-wise. The same with Japan and South Korea. And now what you've done is you've been able to preserve some sort of dollar dominance that that will allow the dollar to survive even after the rest of the world, the global south, dumps the dollar, which is the direction that the Russians, Chinese, and Indians are now headed. Now, this isn't something that Donald Trump can articulate publicly. First of all, there'd be a whole lot of opposition to him. And so he's using assets, and I use assets in quotation, like Marco Rubio and Secretary Scott Bessent and others, to create this, America's tough, America's, we're going to insist on this, that, and the other thing. And they're taking the lead in sanctioning and isolating the United States. And meanwhile, Donald Trump is solidifying, Fortress America. I think he's, focused on, bringing Canada, Mexico, Central and South America under his thumb. One of his strategic objectives, I believe, is to bring Venezuela under American control. That's a hell of a lot of oil. That's a lot of power. That's a lot of, long-term stability. And I think he's also looking to break China's grip on South America. I don't know, how he's going to do that. But, you and I have talked about Brazil in the past and the fact that there are significant political forces in Brazil that are opposed to Lula and BRICS and such. And I think the CIA is having a great time right now in Brazil and South America, playing CIA games, recruiting people, lining people up, undermining people to engender instability in the region so that America can appoint its, the autocrats that it likes. I don't know if this is going to succeed, but this is the direction I see the United States going. Marco Rubio leading the charge. I mean, why was he made Secretary of State? Not because he is in favor of peace with Russia, not even because he's a big Zionist. He was made Secretary of State because his big deal is Venezuela and South America. That's his thing. That's his baby. That's his bailiwick. And now he's fully engaged. We're not quitting on Greenland. We're not quitting on Canada. Trump just made a bold pitch to the South Koreans for them to sell land to America or give land to America where the military base, so it's American soil. I don't know where that's going to go, but I can say that the economic future of South Korea and Japan, will be closely linked to the United States because we've successfully alienated them from the rest of the world. They only have one outlet to go. Europe is broken, and Europe will have no choice but to rally under American control. And this is the Fortress America that I see happening. In order to make this happen, we have to solve the Indian problem. And what I mean by that is we have to cut strings with India. I don't know if this is right. This is just this is me trying to figure out what makes sense, because nothing else makes sense. Nothing makes sense what he's doing. I mean, we are throwing India into the arms of Russia and China. Why? And I think the answer is clear. Because India, in many ways, would represent a poison pill or a potential poison pill to the Russia-China relationship. Because there's just a lot of problems between India and China that aren't going to go away. This border is a big problem. And by compelling India to jump all in to this relationship, you get them to embrace India. And now they got to deal with the poison that is India. And India is pure poison. There's a lot of problems associated with India. I don't know. I don't think this is going to end up being the threesome from heaven. This is going to be the threesome from hell. And I think that's another objective here, is to create problems for Russia and China. Indirect problems. And again, this, the CIA is behind all this. Is CIA, classic CIA thinking and modeling. This is the only thing I can explain. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that this is solid gold and this is exactly, this is true. This is speculation, but nothing else makes any sense. Nothing makes any sense. Why would you literally cut India and encourage them to jump into the arms of Russia and China? Not because you want those three to work out. It's because India is a poison pill that you're feeding to the Russians and Chinese. And because you've created a certain geopolitical reality, China and Russia were willing to embrace India. We'll see where it goes. The bigger story to me is Russia and China and the finalization of this massive energy deal that is literally brings it into Russia-European energy relations large scale. The gas that's being sent to China was supposed to be being sent to Europe over the course of the next decades. No, it's now going to China. Russia now has a very dedicated income stream. This is very stabilizing for the Russian economy. And it's devastating for Europe because now it guarantees that Europe's future will be buying very expensive energy from people. Probably the same energy that's being pumped out of Russia right now, going down to China, and then the Chinese take it in, convert it to liquid natural gas, put it on the big ship running around the Cape up into Europe, and sell it back to the Europeans at 3-5 times the price. You know, I don't care. Europe slit its own throat on this one. But that to me is the big story. The fact that they finally, after, you know, China didn't want to jump. This is the stupidity of Trump, because the fact of the matter is China for a long time was hesitant about sealing this deal. And Russia was too. You know, Russia has concerns about the Far East and China and demographics and, you know, what's going to happen as Chinese population grows and they're looking for land and they look to the Far East and there ain't no Russians in that land. You know, there's a lot of paranoia about that. The Chinese also don't want to limit themselves, link themselves to, you know, Russia and be dependent upon Russian energy long term. They were looking for alternatives. They like that diversity, that energy security that comes with diversity. Nope. Thanks, United States. Thanks to Donald Trump. China and Russia now have just, they've gone straight to, nope, we're linked together now for the next 30 plus years. And that's the big story. That's the biggest story out of the SCO, I believe, is this energy relationship, because this is the one that kills Europe. And it also, and again, I just have to wonder, because, you know, Trump keeps talking about pivoting to the Pacific. You ain't going to pivot to the Pacific now, because there ain't no way you're standing up to this this pairing. And I think that's deliberate, because I don't think Donald Trump's looking for a war against China. I think he's looking to disengage from China. I think he's looking to create Fortress America.
I think China is not looking for any sort of conflict, military conflict with the United States. And as she mentioned on Victory Day, he said that humanity, again, has to choose between peace and war, dialogue and confrontation, win-win cooperation or zero-sum game. How did you find the parade in China? A lot of weapons they've shown, but it's not about attacking any countries. They're talking somehow, they're using their sort of, this sort of representation as they're prepared to defend themselves and what they have achieved so far.
Yeah, you know, the thing that everybody's locked on are the DF5 Cs that were paraded through. You know, oh my God, this is the first time we've seen the DF5C. But we've seen the DF5. It's been around a long time. It's a very big liquid fueled missile. Not very good. Not very good. We know what it is. It hangs out in tunnels and mountains, but it has to be brought out of the tunnel, then raised, and then fueled. It takes 2 hours to fuel it up. 2 hours. Satellites detect it. Time of flight of a counter-strike missile measured in, you know, dozens of minutes. So if they ever start pulling out their DF5s and fueling them up, they're going to be destroyed. I mean, that's just, so why emphasize the DF5? Because it is clearly a weapon of deterrence. It's not a first strike weapon. It's a weapon of deterrence. The new DF5C, 12 warheads on board, big missile. But the Chinese emphasized this. They said, we have nuclear deterrence. They could have emphasized more, you know, in a more direct fashion, their DF-41s, which are solid fuel. They're being punched out and put into silos in Western China. These are sort of like potentially first strike weapons. You know, they could have emphasized those. But the thing everybody's focused on is DF-5s, weapon of deterrence. The parade was clearly a show of strength, but I also believe it's a show of pride. I mean, you know, let's just be straight up honest here. You don't win wars with parade ground troops. I mean, they're good to look at. God, that's impressive. The amount of discipline and training required to do that. Those aren't combat troops, though. Those are parade ground troops. They spent all their time learning how to march like that. And if you learn how to march like that, you ain't learned how to fight. And we should keep this in mind that we saw. Now, that doesn't mean China doesn't have troops capable of fighting. I'm sure they do. I'm sure they have troops out there right now facing off against Taiwan that are fully capable of waging war. But that wasn't what was on display. There's a reason why America doesn't do this. Because you know, we have small contingents of ceremonial troops. So the Marines have the 8th and I, garrison in Washington, D.C. I think it's the three companies of parade-worthy Marines. Very good. They do the silent drill team. They have a band. They do really good stuff. The Army has, the regiment that guards the Tomb of the Unknown Soldiers, also a ceremonial unit. The Navy and Coast Guard and the Air Force all have ceremonial units, and they're used for funerals and for, big events. But we don't have, a division of parade-worthy soldiers because I can speak for the Marine Corps. We're too busy learning how to wage war. We're too busy figuring out how to kill people, not how to march and look sharp. We do that. We can march, but it's not what we do. Any military person is looking at the Chinese going, really good. I mean, same thing with the Russians on Victory Day. Impressive as hell. Impressive as hell. But what you're really looking at is you're looking, for their combat soldiers and how they perform in the field. That's the true measure. And so what China did is put on one hell of a show. And they have every right to. It's the 80th anniversary of the defeat of Imperial Japan. And it's important for China and Russia and North Korea to have a parade like this, because we live in a day where the West is reimagining history, where we've already seen in the 80th Victory Day celebration, Donald Trump and others trying to indicate that it wasn't the Soviet Union that defeated Nazi Germany, it was the United States, Great Britain, and France, and the Soviet Union was sort of there, but they couldn't have done it without us. We were the best in the, it's absurd. The same thing, the defeat of Japan. Yes, I mean, I come from a Marine Corps background. We cut our teeth on island hopping campaigns. I mean, Guadalcanal, Tarawa, Iwo Jima, Okinawa, Peleliu, Saipan, Guam, on and on and on. These were the battles that the Marine Corps made its reputation on. But, in terms of the scope and scale of what the Russians or the Soviets were doing with the Germans, these are small ass battles, tiny little islands, heavy fighting, bloody fighting, important to advance, our air capability, air projection capability. Iwo Jima was captured because we needed an airfield for bombers to recover from in Japan that otherwise would have been lost in the Pacific. This was a naval war in the Pacific. And even then, when it was done, the bulk of Japan's combat power had yet to be engaged. I mean, the Kwantung Army in operating in Manchuria and Korea, over 1 million men. The Japanese forces in that still continue to fight in China, down occupy Southeast Asia, millions of men that had yet to be engaged. And it was China that broke the back of the of the Japanese forces on mainland China. It was the Russians, the dramatic intervention of the Russians in August of 1945 that destroyed the Kwantung Army, broke their back. This is what ultimately this combined with the, two new, atomic bombs got Japan to say, okay, we're done. The United States should have been at that ceremony. I mean, we should have been there. We should have been in Moscow because we did play a role in this war, an important role, a critical role. We were one of the big allies. We were the forge of democracy. Our Lend-Lease helped keep the Soviets in the fight. We were helping the Chinese with, the hump, flying equipment over the Himalayas to keep, Chinese forces logistically supported. We had the Flying Tigers, Chenault's guys out there, doing air operations against the Japanese. And then, of course, there's, what we did after Pearl Harbor, the huge campaign where we, built this gigantic Navy and we went in and conquered the Pacific. We should have been there because we did play a very important role in this victory. And we should have been there to honor the role played by the Chinese, the Russians, and the North Koreans. I mean, you got to respect your history. You got to respect the totality of history, and everything has to have a balance to it. And what Donald Trump done is disgraceful, to pretend that you know, we won the Pacific War, that there was no role played by the Chinese. The Chinese owe their freedom to us. Really, Donald? The vast majority of our support, I think almost the totality of our support, was to the nationalist Chinese, who were also fighting the communists at the same time. It was the communists that kicked the nationalists out in the end of the 1940s. So the Chinese communists don't owe squat to us, except indirectly. We just have to learn our history here. We have to be respectful of history. We don't recognize the role played by the Russians, who lost hundreds of thousands of men to break the Japanese army back. What would happen if Russia hadn't come in? What had happened if Japan had withdrawn those forces to the home islands and made the United States come in and dig them out at the point of the bayonet? You know, how many American lives would have been lost doing that? It's the same thing. We don't respect what the Soviets did in Europe, and we don't respect what the Soviets and the Chinese and the North Koreans did in the Pacific. We're singularly focused on ourselves, and we dishonor the sacrifice of the Americans who've died fighting the Japanese and died fighting the Germans, because I don't think there's a single one of them who would want their role diminished or their role exaggerated. What they did was fantastic. What they did was heroic. What they did was essential to victory, and it should be recognized as such. But nobody wants to be given credit for something they didn't do. Nobody wants that. People want to, if you're going to get credit for what you did. And what we did was a lot. What we did was enough. What we did is help create the conditions for victory. But there's nobody that wants to have glory put upon them that belongs to others. And we should recognize, Americans don't understand what was going on in World War II. We're focused on Guadalcanal. Why not? It was an important battle. But while the Battle of Guadalcanal was raging, are we aware of the major land battles being fought on mainland China, the major land battles being fought in the Southeast Asia? Some Americans have peripheral knowledge of Merrill's Marauders and the war going on between the Japanese and the British along the Indian border in Burma, but not too much. We don't pay too much attention to that. We're too busy worried about these relatively small battles being fought on these islands throughout the Pacific. Are we aware of the Russian offensive that broke the back of the Japanese army, Khalkhin Gol fightings and other battles that were fought, the capture of Port Arthur. The Russians lost hundreds of thousands of men in this fighting, hundreds of thousands. This wasn't small stuff. This is large scale ground warfare. And, we're ignorant of it. We're totally ignorant of the role played by our allies in this strategic defeat of Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan.
Yeah. Scott, here is what Donald Trump said about the China's military parade.
I thought it was a beautiful ceremony. I thought it was very, very impressive. But I understood the reason they were doing it, and they were hoping I was watching, and I was watching. My relationship with all of them is very good. We're going to find out how good it is over the next week or two. I think that we helped China very much, as you know, when they talk about freedom. And I don't believe that, and maybe I'm wrong, I hope I'm wrong, but I don't believe that America, that the United States was acknowledged for helping China to get to gain its freedom. But perhaps that was just that was a sleight of hand. I was very surprised. I watched the speech last night. President Xi's a friend of mine, but I thought that the United States should have been mentioned last night during that speech, because we helped China very, very much.
You know, Scott, what's so amazing about Donald Trump, that he literally says what it is, the way he feels about what's going on. On the other hand, it's somehow... to me, it's unrealistic to put each and every blame on the previous administration, on the Biden administration, with what's going on with Russia and China and even with India, because that doesn't help you if you go to what you cannot change. the Biden administration is gone. There is no Biden administration in Washington. What would you do? What would be the policy of the Trump administration toward Russia and China? You don't see Donald Trump addressing that. Every time he's talking about Ukraine, he's talking about the Biden administration and the catastrophe they have caused in Ukraine. When this sort of change comes to Washington, that the responsibility right now is you, Donald Trump, is not Joe Biden, and you are the president of the United States.
Remember, he's a second term president. His first term was before Joe Biden. And people, need to start taking a closer look at the foreign policy of Donald Trump during this first administration and decisions that were made regarding Russia, China, India, because Donald Trump is singularly responsible for the world the way it is today. He began a process that Joe Biden inherited. Joe Biden didn't deviate from Donald Trump's foreign policy goals and objectives in a substantive fashion. The Ukraine policy was a continuation of the very aggressive, a posture that Donald Trump had taken. This concept that there wouldn't have been a war had he been president is ludicrous. There would have been a war. This war was inevitable because Donald Trump's incapable of making the compromises necessary to have prevented a war. And this war would have happened. It's just convenient for him right now to blame it all on Joe Biden. But it wasn't Joe Biden that put 20 CIA stations in Ukraine between 2017 and 2021 when Donald Trump left office. It wasn't Joe Biden that carried out very aggressive policies against China, trade war policies, policies about Taiwan that further alienated. Joe Biden simply continued these policies. It wasn't Joe Biden that alienated India. It was Donald Trump, objecting to, Russian military sales, etc. So Donald Trump lives in a never-never land. I mean, a fantasy land of his own construct. I think the differences between then and now is he has a world vision today that he's ready to implement aggressively. I think in his first term, he had vague concepts, but he really didn't know what he was trying to achieve and how he was trying to achieve it. But the time he had between his first term and his second term, watching Joe Biden allowed him to come up with a vision that I believe he's trying to implement today. But in order to do that, he has to distance himself from his past policies. And he does that through the convenient vehicle of Joe Biden, to blame everything on Joe Biden. But the fact of the matter is almost every problem that Donald Trump faces today is a problem that was created by Donald Trump in his first term in office.
I think one of the major things that you've mentioned about this summit was these two pipelines. The second one is Power of Siberia, number two. And it's going to be operational, I think, by 2030. And in 5 years, they're going to have it. And they're talking about it as we know. But how much of pressure that would bring to Europe and the future and the policies of Europe?
No pressure put on Europe because of this, because there's no, in order to have pressure, you have to have something to put pressure on, a relationship, a status. What is the status between Europe and Russia today? Europe continues to view Russia as the boogeyman and use them as a justification for, policies that are bringing about the economic destruction of Europe and the geopolitical isolation of Europe. Russia has divorced itself from Europe. It doesn't need Europe. In many ways, doesn't want Europe, has no desire for Europe. So, this is a statement of finality. Basically, that gas was supposed to be developed for Europe. That was Europe's long-term, economic source of economic energy security. It's now going to China, and there's no going back on that. This is it. It's your the nation I want to be is Mongolia. I mean, just sitting there minding your own business, being good. Yeah, and all of a sudden they go, oh, by the way, we're going to put a pipeline across your territory and you're going to be gifted several billion dollars a year, sort of free. Have fun. Mongolia's going, really? How about two pipelines? You know, but you know, Mongolia is they're the ones going, wait, what? We won the lottery. You know, so good for Mongolia.
Yeah, I think that's what Ukraine has lost.
Oh, totally. They're idiots. I mean, the Ukrainian-European collusion on idiocy is unprecedented in modern history. They literally, if you could have gone back in time to 2020 and wrote a paper, said, list the 10 things that if you did it would bring about the total destruction of Europe and Ukraine. They've done them all. And they've added a bunch more just for good measure. It's mind-boggling what they've done and why they've done it.
Scott, there was a meeting, there was a briefing in Russia, and Gerasimov, he represented, look at the wall and the new map that they're representing. Do you think that they're serious about it, or it's with some sort of, I don't know, they wanted to make some sort of news out of it? How serious is that, the concept of having Odessa and Nikolaev going up to Kharkov, being part of Russia, in the mind of Russian government, Russian administration, the Putin administration?
Let me put it this way. You know, studying Russia and studying, you know, the military and the Russian presidency for the past 25 plus years, the Russian military would not do this on its own volition, meaning that if Gerasimov woke up and said, go ahead and make this map, put it up on the wall so the whole world can see, you know, there are ramifications to this. And if you took the presidency by surprise, Gerasimov would probably be out of a job, and so would everybody who was involved in that really, really bad decision. So I think that map appearing where it does was a deliberate act that was coordinated with the Russian presidency. And it's sending a clear signal. You know, Russia has said for some time now, and they warned the Ukrainians back in June of this year, accept Vladimir Putin's proposal, which was basically the Istanbul communicated, updated to reflect current realities. Kherson, Zaporizhia, Donetsk, and Lugansk will be part of Russia forever. And we can bring it into this war. And all the other territories will belong to you. Yes, there would be buffer zones. There would have to be buffer zones. But in the end, once the military aspects of the conflict were resolved and there was political stability, those buffer zones would disappear. But the concept of buffer zones exists for a reason. The Russians have said that, you know, we have to push the Ukrainian forces back in a way that they don't threaten critical Russian infrastructure. Odessa and Nikolaev have been turned into a launching pad for Ukrainian military resources used to strike Crimea, Krasnodar, and into southern Russia. I think what we're seeing here is a reflection of reality, that when this conflict ends, first of all, no matter what, when this conflict ends, Odessa and Mykolaiv will be occupied by the Russians, part of their buffer zone. That's just the way it's going to be. But I think what Russia is saying is, and you're never getting it back, because Ukraine has been using, together with the British and others, been using Odessa to strike Crimea. It's now, you can't speak of security on Crimea if Odessa is in the hands of, you know, a potential enemy. I think, you know, Russia has made this move. It's not part of their formal, formally stated objectives at this point, but I think it's clear with that map that when this war ends, Odessa and Mykolaiv will be part of the Russian Federation. And that's just the price Ukraine plays for being stupid. And if they continue, I think another map will be produced. And that one will show Dnipropetrovsk, Kharkov, and Sumy is part of Russia. And if they want to continue to play stupid games, then the Russians can, you know, move into Chernihiv. Where are they going to stop? They'll stop where they need to stop to achieve their objectives. But I think this was a deliberate signal on the part of the Russian Federation, in a coordinated fashion, that Odessa and Mykolaiv will be part of Russia when this is over.
It was somehow amazing that we haven't heard anything about Ukraine during the summit, in the aftermath of the summit. It seems that, I don't know if they talk about it and they kept it somehow out of the reach of the media, but it didn't seem that China even wanted to have Ukraine issue on that platform. How did you feel about that?
I actually think it was talked about. For instance, Putin and Kim Jong-un talked about the North Korean involvement in Kursk. And Kim Jong-un made it clear that North Korea is there for Russia. We are there for Russia. You call, we come, kind of stuff. And Putin was very, very positively about the heroism of the North Korean forces that fought in Kursk. So clearly they mentioned this. With the Chinese, I think, one of the hesitations on the part of China in the past few years in signing the new Siberian 2 deal is the conflict in Ukraine and the instability that is engendered by this conflict. I think signing this deal is the biggest statement China can make, that we're all in with Russia. There are no longer any obstacles. We are in all the way. And they wouldn't have done that without Russia telling them what their objectives are. You don't enter into a strategic relationship of this scope and scale, not knowing what Russia's intent is regarding Europe and the United States. And so there's no doubt in my mind that Putin and Xi had a very long talk about what Russia is going to get to, including that new fancy map. Meaning Russia said, oh, by the way, Odessa, and Chinese went, okay, you got to do what you got to do. We got your back. And to prove we got your back, here's that 30-year energy deal. Signed, sealed, delivered, done. Don't worry about it. We're not holding it back, trying to use it as leverage for you to have a nice relationship with Zelensky anymore. It's there in writing. So I think that the Ukrainian conflict was front and center. They don't have to shout it out, but it's so obvious what happened here. To everybody, China's all in on Russia's side in this conflict. North Korea's all in on Russia's side in this conflict. And I dare say, because Russians like to deal with things in a, in terms of reciprocal responsibilities and obligations, Russia's all in with China on Taiwan if the time comes for that to ever happen. So, this is huge, huge tactical or strategic mistake by the West to allow this meeting. Again, if I were advising Donald Trump, but I'm not, but if I were, I would have said, you got to go to Moscow in May and you got to go to Beijing in September. Just make your presence there. Show up, give a speech, because they will have to receive you and listen to you, and you will alter whatever strategic deals they're trying to cut. You will be a force of disruption. If you want to drive a wedge between Russia and China, show up in Moscow on May Day, because now Putin has to pay attention to you at the expense of the attention he was paying to China. Show up in Beijing in September. Xi has to pay attention to you. It means he has to take away time he's spending with Putin. And he's not going to put a thumb in your eye by, signing deals at this point in time that would make you uncomfortable because you've made this grand gesture of coming to Beijing. Instead, he stayed home and made stupid statements about both. Just not a very bright man. And he's definitely advised by some of the worst advisors in the history of advisors, because we literally are making the job of Russian, Chinese, Indian rapprochement the easiest thing in the world. We're basically writing the playbook for them.
Scott, do you feel that the idea of attacking or in having some sort of military conflict with China, which we heard the head of military, U.S. military in Japan, he said during the Biden administration, by 2025, they're going to have some sort of conflict with China. Do you think that idea has disappeared from Washington, or we're going to have it considering the new administration, the Trump administration? And here he is, before going to the answer, Here is what the U.S. ambassador to NATO said on Fox News.
These other countries are having to respond. And, you know, China, I will note, I mean, most of the military equipment they demonstrated in this parade was technology most likely stolen from the United States or our allies. And, you know, they can't, couldn't fight the United States if they tried. You know, we are the only world superpower with the biggest, strongest economy. And that's what we need to continue to do. We need to continue to invest in our defense. And we also need to make sure that we continue to protect the American dream.
You get the sense of.
Well, let's just make some statements of fact here. This is the American ambassador to NATO. He has no military experience, none whatsoever. So you handed him an M16, he wouldn't know how to disassemble it, reassemble it, fire it, etc. You know, he was a prosecutor in, I guess, Idaho, southern Idaho, maybe, where he got a reputation for taking down, you know, drug dealers or drug smugglers. Yay, good job, you. That's it. That's his experience. He knows nothing about anything. And now he's in NATO making stupid statements. This is another guy that, if I were advising the president, I'd say fire him immediately with prejudice and send the signal, thou shall not open your mouth about major policy issues while I'm president, unless thou clear with me. But you don't have the remit to sit there and say stupid things that undermine. This is a man that called Putin, I mean, he called him names before the Alaska summit. I forget what name he called him, but it was, you know, something just deeply insulting. An American ambassador who, when he opens his mouth, isn't speaking on behalf of the Secretary of State. Ambassadors speak on behalf of the President of the United States. So that's the president speaking when he speaks, saying the stupidest things. He needs to be terminated immediately. He should never work in government again. He should be selling, you know, used cars somewhere in Idaho. But he should never have any responsibilities that are linked to the national security of the United States, because not only is he getting us in trouble in Europe and Ukraine, not only is he trying to undermine the president's policies of trying to improve relations with Russia, now he's saying stupid things about China. Just totally ludicrous thing. The only good news is that China could care less. I mean, this is just a bald-headed idiot, you know, a guy who shaves his head every morning thinking that he's got Telly Savalas cool going, but all he has is just stupidity. You know, this guy exudes, you know, moron status. And I know I've just insulted everybody because those are politically incorrect terms, but I don't know what else to say about this guy. It's humiliating what he's done here. He's a man who knows nothing about the military, nothing about the military. And he has no underlying intelligence to back this up. This is purely him just sitting there spewing crap. Spewing crap. It's not like he read an intelligence report that said, oh, the latest Chinese missile technology was stolen from General Dynamics on this date. And this, we have reason to believe by looking at the blueprints that this was incorporated. He doesn't know any of that. He'd never operated in that world. He doesn't get to read that kind of stuff. So he's just there saying stupid things, and he's being allowed to say it. That's what's frustrating. This isn't the first time. Normally, before an ambassador goes on national TV, you know, the questions are going to be asked to the ambassador are, you know, submitted, and then they will come up with answers, and those answers will be staffed back to the State Department, back to the White House. Because, again, the ambassador, when he opens his mouth or her mouth, speaks as if they are the president. And, you know, they need to be clear. I think this guy's just getting on, you know, Fox News or whatever channel had him on there, and he's just doing it to, you know, cause trouble. I don't think there's any direction here. I just think he's there doing it. And it's very bad for the United States. It makes us look really stupid. Anyways, that's it.
But do you see the possibility of having a direct conflict militarily between the United States?
No, because the military professionals are professional. We're not suicidal. We can be told to prepare for war, and we will, but let's parse this out a little bit. The Marine Corps, back when Biden became president, the new commandant, his name was Berger, he did a dramatic restructuring of the Marine Corps to try and be able to position the Marine Corps to live up to the responsibilities that were incurred with the new national security strategy and Defense Department, Secretary of Defense guidance. Because he looked at what the Marine Corps had, and he said, these are, you know, we operate off of legacy systems using legacy doctrine, and we can't fulfill our responsibility. So he restructured the Marine Corps in a way to create these, you know, maritime capable units that could wage conflict in the South Pacific, on the islands, long range strike. They have, you know, Tomahawk capability and other missile capability to strike, you know, Chinese shipping and to move here, move there, and all this kind of stuff. And it failed. It failed. Today, the Marine Corps is looking at what has happened. They said, we can't accomplish. I mean, this is a failed concept. It didn't work, and it's not going to work. So the Marine Corps has got to reassess, you know, what it's done. The Navy, you know, they have to take a look at some things. We have ships that are poorly maintained. We have operational tempo and manpower shortages that have unqualified people at the helm of these ships. So they keep running into tankers or running into themselves or running into, you know, reefs underground. A submarine did that a while back. We don't have weapon systems. I mean, you know, our big thing about projecting naval force is that we're able to project power. We have limited number of missiles. We have a limited number of, you know, anti-ballistic missiles. We're going up against the Chinese that have, you know, tons of these things, hundreds, thousands of them. They'll just overwhelm us, saturate. We can't defend. We don't have power projection. To move forces into Taiwan, you know, we didn't, for a long time, we didn't have a Taiwan operations order because it was against the law to do it. So what was done, I believe, was they took the South Korea war plan, which basically involves moving hundreds of thousands of troops from the United States into South Korea. And they just said, we'll make certain adjustments to get these troops allocated to Taiwan. But the problem is, it's not like we have a whole additional group of forces. If we start flowing troops into Taiwan, we no longer can defend South Korea. We don't have the ability to do both at the same time. And we don't have the troops to send into Taiwan. They're not earmarked. We don't have, you know, pre-positioned equipment. We've restructured our military such that we are incapable of effectively reinforcing. It would take years to bring reserve units up to strength, to train them, get their equipment ready. We don't have the shipping anymore to do this. We couldn't do it all in one haul. We'd have to be doing a relay in war against the Chinese Navy that has the ability to interdict using missiles, aircraft, ships, submarines. And so I think, you know, Pete Hegseth, the one thing he did say in the lead up, he said at his time in the Pentagon, you know, he was familiar with the war games that were run every year about a potential conflict with China. And he said, every year we lost. We can't beat the Chinese. And the situation's only gotten worse. You know, I don't know what we're spending money on in the military, but we're not spending money on anything that's improving our combat strength right now. You know, we need a basic, you know, from the ground level on up, reevaluation of what we want our military to do. And we have to be realistic about this. If we want to fight in the Pacific, we have to start building ships, lots of ships. And we have to double or triple the size of the Marine Corps or bring Army units up to speed in terms of amphibious warfare operations. We have to pre-position a lot of equipment in the Pacific because our logistics are going to be strained. You don't want to be shipping everything across. So you're going to need to get Australia, you need to get bases, pre-position everything, redo our complete war plan. This is going to cost, you know, hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollars. And then you have to ask yourself why. Because the only way to do this is to project power in offensive military operations, not defensive in nature. And we may not have the capacity even to do this nowadays because our economy is not up there. Our military, you know, Americans, you know, don't want to fight. You know, we're having a hard time recruiting. I know there's been an upsurge since Donald Trump came in. But how many of those are truly combat capable? Because the other problem we have is, you know, America's become the land of fat bodies. Did you see those Chinese soldiers? I didn't see a round belly on a single one of them. Okay, these boys were fit. Maybe that's what comes by eating, you know, rice and lean chicken. I don't know. That was the most racist thing I've said all day, and I apologize for it. But my point is, they ain't eating what we're eating. And whatever they're doing in terms of physical exercise, I have to tell you, I've done a lot of parades in my time when I was in the Marine Corps. And, you know, we couldn't march like that. Oh, that's for damn sure. We did all right, but not like that. But the physical fitness required to do what those guys did, the discipline, the precision. These are physically fit soldiers, and a whole bunch of them. We don't have physically fit people in America today. I mean, yeah, I can go to the gym, you know, find a couple of gym boys out there that are, you know, lifting, but they're not fit. Do they do cross training? I can go to the CrossFit gym and I'll find a handful, you know, but they're not combat fit. They can do the little CrossFit thing, but, you know, take them out, put 90 to 120 pounds on their back, walk them for 20 miles, and then make them do a combat evolution. And there's not too many people that can do that. And yet that's what's required. We don't do that anymore. We don't have that many. The Marine Corps and some of the Army units do have people that can do this kind of stuff. But generally speaking, our military has become a bunch of fat boys, fat women, out of shape, incapable of performing any duty under stress and combat conditions. And in order to do half the stuff that we would need to do to effectively confront China and the Pacific, we would have to, you know, basically double the size of our military. Where are we going to get them? Volunteers? No. And if we did, we'd have to lower the standards so much that we just, you know, become we might as well just open up Baskin and Robbins ice cream centers, you know, and lure in the fat bodies and say the fatter the better. You know, but it's America's got some serious structural problems that we have to overcome. And I would say that rather than spend all this time fixing military things that don't, we don't need to be doing that. I believe we have to have the ability to defend ourselves. I believe we have to have one of the finest militaries in the world. I believe that we have a duty and obligation to create a military so that anybody who sought to attack us or threaten our national security understood that they would be going up against a military force that is very capable and could very well defeat them in combat. I want the world to be afraid of the American military, afraid of attacking America. But I don't think the world should wake up every morning and see an American fleet off their shores. That's not our job or not our responsibility. I just drove my wife to work this morning, and it's funny, you know, as we approach her business, we've been doing this for 25 years. The same damn potholes are there. Boom. I mean, I could close my eyes and literally count them off as I hit them. Boom, one here, what we got another coming up, boom, because they're there, the same potholes for 25 years. They just did a complete renovation of a parking garage, and the apron leading up to the parking garage has fresh asphalt on it. But then you get to the road that takes you to that parking garage, and it's the same potholes. Yes, they come in and they patch them every year, and gosh, they haven't taken care of the underlying problem, because next thing you know, it rains, ice, boom, and the pothole's back. The same pothole. It's all over. Bridges falling down. I mean, we got entire parts of the town landing at JFK, coming out of JFK is just a national embarrassment. I landed at JFK and all of the, escalators and the moving walkway. You know, I tend to, when my knee's not bother me, I like to walk, so I avoid it, and that's my option. But it's there for people who have been on an airplane for many hours and their knee, you know, legs aren't up moving. I was just in Switzerland, in Zurich, everything works. I was in Moscow, everything works. Everything works. Everything works. I was in JFK, nothing works. Nothing. It's an embarrassment. And this is where the world comes into America. This is what they see initially. And then they get out and they get into this airport that's been under construction now for how long? And the traffic is congested. The parking is horrific. It takes forever to get in and get out. Nothing moves efficiently. This is America. This is what we need to fix. Amtrak just put up a high-speed train. You know, we're connecting Boston with Washington, D.C. Well, how can you have a high-speed train if you don't have rail lines capable of handling high-speed traffic? And you don't. You know, any high-speed train going from New York City to Washington, D.C. has got to pass through Philly. And I'm telling you right now, if you want to get up and buy a cheeseburger at the Amtrak cafe car, don't get out of your seat while you're going through Philly, because that train is rocking back and forth and you're getting slammed around. And that's America. That's America in a big city on a major, north, south, eastern corridor. This is what we need to fix. This is what would make America great again. Not projecting military power into regions that we don't need to project power into. If we want to save Taiwan from invasion, then we should work with the Chinese on, you know, a one nation, two systems policy, so that, you know, Taiwan can retain as much of their of that which makes them unique, without alienating, mainland China. That's what we should be doing, so that we can keep our foot into Taiwan and get a foot into China. Leverage, you know, this peacemaking possibility into something that gives us, you know, the ability to compete inside China. No, instead we're talking about spending hundreds of billions of dollars to build up a military capability we can't build up. We're never going to match the Chinese for shipbuilding again. Never. They're just pumping out ships like you wouldn't believe. We're not. That's what I would do. And fix America. Make America great again. Make America great. I mean, God, we have such potential in this country if we could just do it. Imagine if we could actually get our education system online. So instead of graduating high school seniors that have a fifth grade reading comprehension level and no mathematical skills, we graduated people that could be absorbed into universities that would be capable of enhancing their level of education so that they were an asset to the workforce when they graduated, and we could compete with, you know, why do we need so many, what do they know what they're, you know, the visas that, you know, people require to come in, you know, that we can use to bring in Indians and Chinese and people that have, you know, certain, you know, technical skills. I'm not against it. We're a land of immigration. Please, I have no problem bringing in especially highly qualified people who want to be American citizens. The more the better. But why are we dependent upon this? Why aren't we pumping them out? Why don't we have sufficient, human resources of American-born citizens who went through the American education system? Instead, we're producing generations of failures who aren't able to fully integrate into this, and then we have that leads to the degeneration of the quality of society: high crime, drugs, an indifferent society, fat people who couldn't serve their country even if they wanted to. These are the things we should be focused on, not trying to build a military capable of standing up to China over the Taiwan issue.
Totally agree with that. Scott, before wrapping up, what was the benefit of killing Israeli army, Israeli military killed the prime minister of Yemen together with his cabinet members? What is the benefit out of this for Israel?
Netanyahu has a template. It's a template that was successful to a certain extent against Hezbollah. And he referred to it when he was talking about striking Iran. He said the Nasrallah template. And the idea is you decapitate the leadership, you sow chaos and confusion, and eventually the target collapses on the weight of its own inefficiencies and hesitancies. You make people scared to become part of the government. They tried that against Iran with their decapitation strike. It didn't work. Now they've done it against the Houthi. But, you know, they took out a prime minister and I think 11 of his cabinet members, you know, people that did sports and health and big threats. But they're replaceable. I mean, the Houthi, you know, he didn't take out, you know, the ideological head of the Houthi movement. He took out, you know, the government. The government can be replaced readily, easily, and will be replaced. But this is the Nasrallah template. The goal is to break the will of the Houthi to continue the fight, to create enough doubt within the ranks of the Houthi that people will be hesitant to continue to fire missiles against Israel. I think they don't understand Yemen, and they don't understand the Houthi, and they don't understand the fact that this isn't going to break them. These are a people committed on the path that they're on. They will continue to resist until which time Israel stops its genocide against Gaza, allows humanitarian goods to flow back in, agrees to a ceasefire. This is the reality. But the idea was basically to replicate the success they had against Hezbollah in Lebanon.
Thank you so much, Scott, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
No, thanks for having me.